You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Influence is about knowing what you believe in, having the confidence to project British values internationally, looking outwards, not inwards, and utilising our unique history and our position as a force for good.
If only it was that simple. In the wake of the resignation of the UK's International Development Secretary Priti Patel, we'll ask where next for Theresa May's disappearing cabinet. My guests Phil Clark and James Rogers will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Saudi Arabia's anti-corruption purge, if that's what it is. Is it merely a scene setter for something even more dramatic? Should far-right attention seekers be confronted or ignored? And at least one president of the United States ends up in court. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, and James Rogers, head of international journalism studies at City University here in London. Welcome both. And we will start in the United Kingdom, where it is hard to believe that it's only 5 months since its present government was elected, more or less, on a pitch of strong and stable leadership. Prime Minister Theresa May is perched perilously on the line that separates the merely embattled from the downright beleaguered, having had to accept the resignations of two cabinet ministers in a week, while clearly dearly wishing she could ask for the resignation of at least one other. James, first of all, the two who have gone are, of course, Priti Patel over this brouhaha over her off-the-books freelance diplomacy in Israel, and the Defence Secretary, Mr. Fallon. They both had to go, didn't they?
It looks like it, and I think in normal circumstances it's quite possible that the Foreign Secretary might also have gone by now, but we're not living it in normal circumstances, and the Conservative Party and the Cabinet which the Prime Minister finds around her are just having to stumble on, really. They know that many of their problems are rooted in the fact that last summer's election did not go as it was supposed to, and in normal circumstances, we might also be heading towards another election. And it seems to me that it's only that threat, an election which the Conservatives believe they might quite possibly lose, and by the way, the opinion polls tend to support that view, which is keeping them in any form of unity whatsoever.
Phil, as James suggests there is some suggestion that in normal circumstances, Boris Johnson, the Foreign Secretary, would have done more than enough to earn himself the boot. And there is therefore some suggestion that, you know, it's that whole losing two cabinet ministers in a week could be misfortune, three would begin to look like carelessness. But is there an argument, uncharacteristic though it would be for Theresa May, for at this point the just death or glory mass purge?
It has got to that stage. This is pure desperation now. I mean, I think what's remarkable about this situation in the UK is that this was in an extremely tenuous government to begin with no outright majority after the last election. And all of the focus was on the backroom machinations. Would May be able to keep the support of her own party? What kind of coalition with the DUP in Northern Ireland would she need? No one saw the two latest crises that she's had to deal with. Firstly, a sexual harassment issue, which has led to Fallon's sacking, and now this whole situation with Priti Patel and, as you put it, sort of freelance diplomacy in Israel. That this was an already weak government that now is having to deal with all of these kind of new controversies and brouhahas that have absolutely come out of nowhere. It's almost impossible to run an effective government in this kind of atmosphere.
I was looking forward to using the word brouhaha myself, but never mind. You can have that one. James, looked at from a perspective of media and perceptions, of course, that it is a terrible moment for any government. And I think the last time really this happened in this country was the dwindling days of the John Major's administration in 1997, when there just does become a perception, even among people who may have voted for you and be broadly sympathetic to your party, that the whole thing has just completely fallen to pieces, that you have at least one foot on the spiral of doom. Has Theresa May reached that point? And if she has, is there any way back off it?
I suspect there isn't any way back off it, because I don't think her own party will forgive her for not increasing their majority in the last summer. And I think if they could find a viable alternative candidate, she would already have gone. She seems to be generally acceptable to what is at the root of it a very divided party. And these things do keep happening. I think the comparison with the late major years in the mid to late 90s is very valid. But let's not forget, Andrew, by that time the Conservatives have been in power for 18 years.
They have.
The Conservatives may have had the Prime Minister for the last 7 years, but they have only had a majority government for one of those years. So it's remarkable how quickly we've got to this very similar stage when everything seems to be unravelling. I mean, as Phil says, no one saw these last two things coming. It seems that no one includes the Prime Minister as well.
Phil, we should contemplate the new Secretary of State for International Development, Penny Mordaunt. She's probably been, well, her best known interjection into the national conversation was during the Euro referendum, when she said things about Turkey joining the EU, which were obviously untrue. The jury remains out on whether she knew it was untrue and said it anyway, or didn't know it was untrue. Neither of which is good. Are we enthused about her elevation?
No, this is a startling development. I think, as you say, she has this track record on the Turkey issue during the EU referendum. She has clearly no diplomatic or foreign affairs experience, no interest even in issues of development, as far as I can see. I mean, the obvious candidate to replace Priti Patel, to my mind, was Rory Stewart, who's currently the Minister of State for Africa, who does have diplomatic experience, having played a key role in Afghanistan.
He did rather forlornly tweet yesterday that he was in Congo and the Wi-Fi was a bit rickety, as if you know, very thinly veiled, suggesting, so if anyone's trying to call me, but yes, he would have seemed the obvious choice, and yet
he may not come back from Congo now. He may find it's better news to join various rebel movements or you know, play for the England cricket team, which seems in a sort of equally parlous state to the British Parliament
Let's not start gloating yet. We start gloating when we're 2-0 up with three tests to play.
A fair way to go. But I mean, clearly the issue here is that Penny Mordaunt has been sort of parachuted into this position because she also is a Brexiteer, just as Priti Patel was. So it shows how crucial this whole issue of Brexit is. And it's completely warping the personalities who are being foisted into these very top positions. I think the other thing that this shows is just the fundamental lack of depth of political talent. I mean, not just in the Conservative Party, but I think right across the British political spectrum at the moment, that once you lose the kind of the top brass from these key roles, that there aren't really ready-made replacements to step into their shoes.
This is a limitation of the Westminster system, of course, that you have to build your government from what you've actually got on the bench. And that's not necessarily always going to be of reliable quality. Just finally on this, James, is Theresa May basically only the UK's Prime Minister at the moment because nobody else really wants the job? Is there actually a plausible successor?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think she certainly is because nobody else, her party could not agree on somebody who could easily replace her. And also, you know, if we look at the situation in which the Conservative Party finds itself, I think if you were an up-and-coming potential leader, you might be well advised from a career strategic point of view to just keep a fairly low profile for now, because there are many ways in which this government, this parliament can end badly, and it's quite hard to see really in some ways how it can end well. So you might be better biding your time.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at a country which serves as an enduring reminder that strong and stable government isn't everything. This is, of course, the ossified theocracy of Saudi Arabia, the present internal conniptions of which are exercising professional readers of Middle Eastern runes. Circa 200 people are now being held in a dramatic purge being billed as an anti-corruption drive. An interesting idea in a state whose entire reason for being is the enrichment of one family. Among the detainees are once powerful princes, politicians and businessmen. That's very definite. Definitely businessmen. And in a debatably related development, Riyadh has also instructed all Saudi citizens in Lebanon to leave immediately. That's going to ruin a lot of people's holidays. Phil, that first development, first of all, is Saudi gearing up here to take a pop at Lebanon, or just do they just wish to create the impression it's the sort of thing they might be thinking about?
I mean, either this is a monstrous diversion from all of the press coverage of this ongoing purge, or this is something truly petrifying. terrifying about potential Saudi aggression against Lebanon in the days to come. One of these is clearly a much more apocalyptic reality than the other one. I mean, the thing that fascinates me is that only a week ago, much of the Western press was basically lauding this new crown prince as a liberaliser and a moderniser. And, you know, here was the great opening up of this very closed regime. This week, the news has taken this very dark turn with details of this purge. So I think at root, what it shows is that the very little grasp that many journalists and observers on the outside, in fact, have of the way that this regime operates.
It's not easy to get a grasp on the way it operates, in fairness for journalists, as they won't let any of us in. James, another development breaking in the last couple of hours is that Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, is making a surprise last-minute spontaneous visit to Riyadh. France obviously has a historical relationship with Lebanon. Why might President Macron be undertaking this mission?
I think it's a sign of the international concern with which the situation developing in the region is viewed. I mean, as Phil says, you know, there have been since the Crown Prince hosted what was called in many sections of the press Davos in the desert, where he outlined his plans for future investment. There has been a lot of very sort of favourable and cautiously optimistic coverage of Saudi Arabia, but then, of course, over the weekend we had the stories of the missile being fired from Yemen at Saudi, and we also had the story of the resignation of the Lebanese Prime Minister, who's obviously had very close ties to Saudi. So I think there is some very complicated wider regional politics going on alongside this very major domestic story in Saudi itself. I mean, if you look at the detentions to which you referred, one really is left to ask is can you have a revolution where the King and the Crown Prince remain in power? Because in terms of the purge of the political class and business class and diplomatic class that seems to be going on, it really is nothing short of revolutionary.
Phil, James mentions there the resignation of Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri and his close ties to Saudi Arabia, ties so close, in fact, that he resigned as Prime Minister of Lebanon from Saudi Arabia on Saudi Arabian state television, despite not only being Prime Minister of Lebanon, but actually owning his own TV channel in Lebanon, who presumably would have found him the airtime. Have we figured that one out yet? Because I tend towards betting with form and his own family history. I'm quite sympathetic to his putative reason was that he was frightened of getting blown up.
Yeah, I think so. And clearly this goes in the water in Lebanon, given what happened to Rafiq Hariri only 7 or 8 years ago.
Among many other Lebanese politicians.
Indeed. You know, the Hariri assassination is still being investigated and prosecuted by the special tribunal. I don't think we're ever going to get to the bottom of that, if only because no witnesses want to come forward to speak about it. So, I think he would have undoubtedly very clear reasons for not wanting that position any longer.
James, going back to the anti-corruption purge in Saudi Arabia, and with all due respect to the fact that, as we were just discussing, it's very, very difficult to know what's actually going on in Saudi Arabia because they won't let anybody go there and report on it. But is there any possibility at all that the anti-corruption purge is an actual anti-corruption purge, or is it a bit more akin perhaps to what we've seen in China, i.e. something which is billed as and may indeed kind of be an anti-corruption purge, but is also a vast and ruthless apparatus for the whacking of one's political enemies?
I think it's probably both. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at some of the expressions which have been, you know, written in Arab News, the Saudi English language publication, corruption does definitely emerge as something which does bother what is one of an overwhelmingly young population who can't in many cases get a decent foot on the career ladder because of vested interests, and because, I mean, the story reported just this evening, just before we came on air, that they're talking in sums of $100 billion worth of corrupt money has apparently been discovered in the course of this investigation and interrogation, which began on
that
Saturday.
Sounds a suspiciously headline-friendly figure.
It does indeed, but it sounds like a suspiciously colossal amount of money if it's anywhere close to the truth. And you can see that in a country where, you know, as in many parts of the Arab world, there is an overwhelmingly young population who lack decent career prospects, you can see that wealthy people exchanging illicit money with each other at the top is not going to go down well, and cracking down on them is.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Phil Clark and James Rogers. Coming up next, is there any point in speaking to the unspeakable?
Monocle has bureau around the world. in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo. Once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. It's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. Most months, actually, most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested. You know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Mullister. With me are Phil Clark and James Rogers. Now, listeners here in the UK and people elsewhere able to watch British TV station Channel 4 will later tonight be able to see the documentary Angry, White and American by Gary Young. It will probably be very good, as Young is a very good reporter, but it has been heavily trailed with Young's interview with Richard Spencer, the American white supremacist and nitwit, which once again prompts the question of whether such encounters do any good. Are they meritorious exposures of malevolent charlatans or merely titillating indulgence of irrelevant yahoos? James, from a media point of view, a journalism point of view, that question first, it comes up a lot. Mm. It is an incredibly vexed question about whether do you go and interview these people because they are part of a story, or are they really not that big a deal and then they then get turned into a big deal because journalists go and interview them? Because the basic ugly truth of the whole thing, the great unsayable, I think, at the heart of this, is that the far right are box office, aren't they?
Mm. They are box office, but also, unfortunately, in the world in which we live, they're becoming increasingly influential.
But there is, where are you on the chicken and egg question prompted by that? Have these people become influential because the media keeps giving them coverage, or are they getting coverage because they're influential?
I think they're probably an example of modern coverage not being in the mainstream media to a large extent. You know, they invented themselves to a large extent on social media, on their own channels, their own echo chambers, talking to their own supporters. And this is the way that a lot of electoral and political communication is conducted these days. In terms of journalistic ethics, there is a very strong case for certainly not talking to them day by day. I think there is also a perfectly reasonable journalistic ethics case for talking to them from time to time, particularly given, as I say, because their influence is growing at the extremes, it is also growing in the mainstream, and things seem to be entering public discourse which would have been largely unsayable 10 or 20 years ago, or would have been ignored at least. And Gary Young, as you may have seen in some of the pieces that he's written, has outlined his own ethical dilemmas in doing this and talking about his time as a young journalist when he was required to invite the far-right French leader Jean-Marie Le Pen onto a programme and had great difficulty and decided telling the editor he wasn't willing to do this. So I think sometimes the answer to that question lies in the kind of journalism. Should we report on a daily website, on a daily radio programme, everything that these characters say? Absolutely not. Should we occasionally take a measured, contextualised look at what they're saying? I think we probably should.
I mean, I've seen, Phil, the trailer of the interview with Gary Young of Richard Spencer. Gary Young gives Richard Spencer extremely short shrift, which is doubtless no more or less than Richard Spencer deserves. But the thing is, of course, that Spencer and characters of that ilk, they thrive on outrage, they thrive on attention of any sort, and ultimately has, even if Gary Young puts the guy on TV and says he's a fool and an idiot and has no idea what he's talking about, isn't it the case that Gary Young has ultimately done him a favour?
I went in to watching the interview with that in mind, and I mean, it'll be interesting to see the full documentary this evening, but even in the shorts, what was interesting to me was there were moments where Spencer looked genuinely rattled, and I think that might be sort of at the heart of all of this, and it goes, I think, to James's point about effective journalism talking to the far right as opposed to very ineffective. I think what is ineffective is hectoring these people, screaming at them, yelling epithets, that kind of thing. I think only plays into their hands. What Young seems to be doing is something cleverer than that he kind of pulls his punches. He's very calm, he's very rational, and then he seems to actually genuinely put Spencer off balance. And I think there's something powerful in that, that that could even be the kind of thing that makes a lot of other people on the far right think twice about this Spencer character. They might think, actually, you know, he's pretty bellicose and confident when he's on his own turf, but when he's put in the hot seat and asked some tough questions by someone who is being very deliberately cool and rational, then he's less impressive. So, you know, I think the way that journalists go about this, the kind of tone they adopt, the kind of questions they ask is a big part of the picture.
Yeah. I mean, the comparison that leaps to mind is there was a huge fuss, a brouhaha, if you will, in this country many years ago when there was talk about putting Nick Griffin, who was then the leader of the British National Party, on Question Time, which is the BBC's flagship political discussion show. And at the time, the BNP were quite a big deal, and there were a lot of people who made the point, to which I was broadly sympathetic, that the BNP voters pay their BBC licence the same as everybody else, you know, and he is clearly a part of the national conversation. And eventually he was put on Newsnight, and he did come across, funnily enough, as a hapless, incoherent, sweaty, nervous, and entirely ridiculous character. And not long after that began the sort of slow, inexorable, and now almost complete implosion of the party he led.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was probably it was a difficult decision on the BBC's part, but probably certainly with hindsight, the right one. I mean, I think we have to look a little bit here about the way the media landscape has changed too. You know, as I was saying earlier, a lot of these far-right, alt-right, whatever they want to call themselves, frankly, you know, racist groups, exist in their own social media world, and they will say
the echo chamber.
That's right, precisely, and I think, if none of their leaders, their spokespeople, ever appear on the mainstream media, people will just say, they will tend to think, well, the only reason they're not having them on is because they know that they're right and they want to shut them up. However, and that is why this kind of journalism can be precisely so effective, because a lot of their popularity, these characters, exists in shoring up their own constituency, which they can perfectly well do.
And the outsider narrative helps them.
Exactly. And nowhere are they challenged. They're never going to be challenged on their own Twitter feeds. They're never going to be challenged on their own YouTube channels. And yet they come up for this channel when you get a good, responsible, thoughtful journalist like Gary Young. And that's why I say, don't put them on the front page every day for any old thing that they say, but do occasionally subject them to rigorous journalistic scrutiny.
Phil, is there a way in which you can decide which ones you should and shouldn't bother with engaging with? Because I think we talked about this at the time when there were protests at Berkeley University in California, when that rather tiresome man, Milo Yiannopoulos, was going to speak there. And there were huge demonstrations against him, which are obviously exactly what he wanted, and indeed were exactly the reason he was going to speak. It struck me that it would have been far more powerful if the students of Berkeley had all as one taken the view, well, this man is an idiot, I have absolutely no interest in listening to him talk about anything, so I'm going to find some other way to spend my afternoon. Would that be more effective if these people just end up speaking to, you know, large empty rooms?
I think that, or engage them in rational, calm, cool, collected dialogue. Because I think, as you say, a lot of these individuals are looking for confrontation. And some of this, I think, too, has also been a real challenge to, you know, kind of left-leaning, you know, liberal commentators and students who also seem very uncomfortable with having to listen to views that they don't like. It's been a test of their own tolerance in many ways. I tend to come down on the perspective that it's important even to listen to perspectives you don't like and to challenge them publicly. And it's that public ventilation and rational challenge of these arguments that I think tends in many cases to win the day. There is undoubtedly a risk involved there. And I think Gary Young's article, which he's written subsequent to his interview, says that. He says, look, you know, once you put someone on a platform, you also can't control what they say. What happens if they engage in hate speech? There is a danger that they may be able to hijack the interview and turn it to their own end. So it's not an absolute good, but I think I'm with Gary, and I think with James on this one, that the risk is on balance worth taking.
I guess it just depends on who's asking the questions. Gary Young's program, Angry White and American, is on Channel 4 here in the UK later tonight. The articles by him we've been discussing, also very much recommended. Let's move along finally tonight. And disappointingly, some or other accused Chicagoan ne'er-do-well will not be put through the unimaginably surreal experience of surveying the jury of his peers from the dock and noticing among them the 44th President of the United States. Barack Obama answered
his summons for jury duty yesterday, but was stood down by the judge, depriving Obama of a $17.20 daily stipend. A similar fate befell Obama's predecessor, George W. Bush, when he presented himself for jury duty in Dallas in 2015. That's the last two presidents in a row who have been in court. I wonder if we'll make it a hat trick. James, this is basically a good thing, isn't it? The idea that the former president of the United States returns to life as an ordinary citizen and is therefore compelled to perform the duties of one?
Yeah, but they weren't compelled to perform the duties in the end, were they? They were a bit too famous once they got there. Presumably the judge felt that their presence, quite rightly felt their presence would be a bit of a distraction, and were it to be reported in the media, it would be Mr. Obama's on the jury rather than indeed, what the case was, I suppose.
People are discharged from juries for all sorts of reasons, and if any listeners haven't seen it, I do recommend looking up the list of reasons given by jurors for refusing to serve in Martin Shkreli's case, the disgraced pharmaceutical baron. That is worth looking up, I promise you. It will restore your faith in the people of America. Phil, what I was going to ask you both was whether either of you, ask you, Phil, whether you'd seen or heard of or witnessed, experienced, read about any former or indeed current head of state or government doing something which just seemed weirdly ordinary, because we do forget that they do still have to do stuff. They have lives to lead.
I mean, he hasn't been a head of state, but he may shockingly end up as prime minister of this country. I did end up sharing a quite empty tube carriage one evening with Boris Johnson, who sort of surreally was reading a copy of the Evening Standard with a picture on the front of Boris Johnson. I guess he was doing what Boris seems to do a lot of the time, which was self-regarding in a very public space. I shudder to think that could be an encounter with a man who may be prime minister in a matter of weeks, if not months.
I mean, the strangest one, it was more of a journalistic one rather than a sort of sighting in the wild, as it were. But I did interview the former vice president of the United States, Al Gore, at the Edinburgh Television Festival in 2007 or something. So really not long after I guess 7 years on from the nonsense of 2000. But again, it was just him, you know, and he was just there, and he'd arrived on a sort of aeroplane with normal people, and he did say it did take a while to get used to having to take his shoes off to get on aeroplanes again. He said Air Force Two was a hard thing to walk away from.
Yeah, I can imagine the creature comforts. You miss them quite quickly, probably. I mean, I saw them talking of stories on the tube. I mean, it is. We should point out it is quite the most efficient way of getting around London quite
the
often.
Only
the
only way.
The traffic being what it is. But I'm a little surprised to hear about Mr. Johnson, who does make a lot of his public image about being a cyclist and making a point of arriving for, you know, for government appointments on his bike. But maybe it was a wet evening, Phil. But I also saw the serving Labour Defence Secretary, George Robertson. I also saw on the District Line on the tube lines here in London as well one afternoon.
It wasn't something I saw, but I was related by the politician in question, which was another Secretary of State for Defence, Jeff Hoon, who it turned out was quite the indie rock nerd. And when I challenged him on this, he said I think the previous week he had been to see Ryan Adams at the Astoria. He did say his term in office had been quite the education for his protection detail.
Yeah. I mean, I think we possibly tend to forget, you know, when you're doing a stressful job like being a Secretary of State or being a Prime Minister or being a head of state, it doesn't mean to say that you want to give up your hobbies or you want to forget about them. Possibly you need them all the more. I do remember seeing the former British Prime Minister, now Sir John Major, at Lord's. He was known at the time as a very big cricket fan, and he was there seeing a game in the 1990s. But he was surrounded by rather large gentlemen who I assume were not just his mates he'd gone for a day out at the match with, but probably his security guards.
Well, I think there is an anecdote of our homeland, Phil, in a book by Peter Harcher called The Sweet Spot, when he writes of going to the cricket at the SCG and joining the queue for the gents at lunchtime and noticing that in the queue was the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition and the State Premier, among others. And he said it just struck him that not only had they all just joined the queue, but it hadn't occurred to anybody ahead of them to get out of the way. I think that's quite a healthy state of affairs.
Or to rapidly flee the scene and lock the door. awards, which I'm also surprised didn't have. I once met Mandela in my student days and sort of sweaty palmed went up and shook his hand thinking that I would have some, you know, very in-depth conversation about the state of the cosmos. And he looked me up and down and uttered one sentence. He said, "That's a very green suit." That was the end of my exchange with Mandela.
And that is the end of today's programme. Phil Clark and James Rogers, thank you both very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tasha Kleeman. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thank you for listening.